Attica Locke was born in 1974, when black households like her parents were transitioning into the Reagan-era 1980s. It was the Cosby era, when some families decided that if politics couldn't free a race of people, then surely economic prosperity would. This is the setting of her novel Blackwater Rising. In 2009, she described that era to NPR's Steve Inske from a boat launch in Houston, Texas.
I think the book in some ways was my attempt to understand the people who raised me. People who were transitioning out of, this kind of heady political activism into the Reagan 80s. I was born in that transition. To me, my whole life is the transition from a segregated America to an integrated America.
I'm Jabalani LaFall. We'll speak with the visiting author about her work and her life story on today's Central Standard, following this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. Crusading lawyers, coming of age, morally ambiguous power brokers, hot weather, and black gold and dark water with floating bodies. These are themes for many a political thriller, but today's guest wasn't attempting to fit into a genre per se with her debut release. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Today we welcome writer Attica Locke, whose novel is called Blackwater Rising and covers many of those themes that I just talked about. Locke discusses and reads from Blackwater Rising tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. Attica, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, where does the title Blackwater Rising come from? There's a pivotal early scene in which a woman is being saved from the water, but then we later come to suspect that the Blackwater might also signify big oil. So, which is it?
It's kind of both, actually. And that title actually came late. To be honest with you, I, for a long time, I was just calling it Bayou City, which is Houston's nickname. But I guess a lot of people outside of the South think of bayous as Louisiana. So we were trying to come up with a different name that really represented the book. And there was – it's not only the black bayou and also the black oil, but there's something in the ascendancy that seems to speak to the character Jay Porter standing up again, coming up again, rising.
A dark undercurrent rising from that, so to speak.
Yes.
The book does seem to be a telltale study in writing what you know, a very intimate portrait of Houston, Texas. Tell us about Buffalo Bayou, the setting of the story Blackwater Rising. Tell us about growing up in that area and being in that area.
Houston, God bless it, has wanted to have a river walk like San Antonio for forever. And there's all these plans that never seem to quite take off. But it's this body of water that snakes through the city, going all the way out to the ship channel, which spills out into the Gulf of Mexico. And it sits kind of below the city. There are streets running almost overhead. And when you get on this in the bayou in downtown Houston, you know, it can be kind of pretty. I mean, there are like city lights and but the bayou then kind of weaves through some uglier parts of the city where everything gets really dark. And this whole book came about for me because of an incident that happened with my family years ago, probably in the mid-80s, when my dad was a small-time criminal defense attorney without a lot of money who wanted to throw a party for his wife, my stepmom. And he knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody, and we got this free boat ride. So, you know, we wrapped up some barbecue and foil and had a boombox and got on this boat. And like I said, when you get in it, you know, get in the water downtown, you know, you could kind of pretend like you're in something really cosmopolitan and sophisticated. But when you get out into the weeds later, it gets really dark and black. And we were out there when we heard a woman screaming for help. I was about 11 years old at the time. And then we heard gunshots. And immediately on the boat, this debate broke out about what in the world were we to do in this pitch blackness where we can't even really tell where the trouble is coming from.
Now, don't tell me what happened next, because we want to wait with bated breath and be in suspense as we were in the novel. A similar thing happens
in the
book when the story – it's an unlikely event where the main character, Jay Porter, is taking his wife on the same such bayou cruise and ends up rescuing an unknown woman from the water. Now, did you struggle to make this scene plausible, even though it's a pivotal scene in the book? Because then you'll tell us what happened – in the real bayou boat ride story.
Well, I didn't really struggle. It was plausible to me because I had witnessed a part of it. And in reality, why this memory was so deep for me is that it was the first time I saw my father in a moral argument with somebody with a ticking clock. I mean, we were not sitting around the dinner table trying to decide what you would do in a situation. We were in a moment where we heard gunshots and there was a short amount of time to figure out what to do. And my dad and his best friend got into an argument about what to do. My dad's best friend, they were both in the civil rights movement together and they were both on trial together in 1970 and took two very different paths. My dad's best friend went on to become a minister. My dad became a criminal defense attorney, and they saw this situation completely differently. The minister said, we have a moral obligation to stop this boat and get this woman. And my dad reacted as a dad and said, no, no, my kid is here. My wife is here. We're going to call the police, and that's the end of it. And that's what we did. The book for me was, what if
someone had jumped in the
water?
What
if somebody had jumped in that water? What trouble might you have brought onto the boat? And Blackwater Rising is just jumped off from that point.
Right. And who did jump into the water is your character, your protagonist, Jay Porter.
Yes.
Now, who is Jay Porter?
Jay Porter is a small-time criminal defense attorney. He's a black man who was heavily involved in the civil rights movement. Excuse me. In the late 60s and early 70s, who now finds himself at the dawn of the Reagan era. The book takes place in Texas in 1981. So here is a guy who is trying to psychologically navigate that transition and who believes that he can somehow bury his past. He was on trial. He was involved in the movement and has a lot of scars from that time period that he's kind of buried. And the first chapters of the book, there's this incident on the boat and this woman that he invites into his life that kind of rips the Band-Aid off of these old festering wounds. And he kind of has to look at his past again.
It's interesting that you mention Jay Porter's background. His character is also, a sense, the sort of sociological and historical turret between the Black Power movement and assimilation into the larger racial mainstream consciousness. He's gone from being an agitator to having a law practice in a mini mall.
Yes.
Talk about that transition and how it shapes his worldview.
Well, I mean, I think this is a similar trajectory that my parents had. That let me put it to you this way. When I used to look at pictures of my parents from the movement days, and I would see the marches, and I would see photos from the courtroom and the courthouse, I used to think, oh, my God, they were heroes. It is now at 38 that I look at those same pictures and say, oh, my God, they were children. They were children. It just kind of blows my mind that they were involved in all of this really heady political activity at 19, 20. And then what happened is culturally and politically, the movement just stopped. And because my parents are extraordinarily resourceful and bright people and had children, they realized really quickly that the mood was shifting away from this, and I cannot raise children like this. And so they just got extra degrees. They put on suits. They got some Volvos. And they did what they had to do to raise their children. And Jay Porter is in a lot of ways in a similar situation, that for whatever he was involved in back in the day, to have survived it, to have been on trial but not gone to prison for life, to have not gone crazy like some other people that he was in the movement with – I think he feels like he's been given a second chance, and that he feels like his bargain with God is, if you've given me this second chance, then I'm going to stop all of this rabble-rousing. I'm going to put my head down. I got a pregnant wife. I'm going to raise her. I'm going to make some money. I'm going to create a different kind of – I'm going to follow a different path towards freedom, so to speak.
Yet he jumps off the boat.
Well, some people don't change so easily.
Now, you were named, speaking of your background, after the Attica prison uprising of the early 1970s and come from a legacy of activism. How did that inform your approach in this book? Your real-life father and his friend, a reverend, seemed to mirror the Jay Porter character and Reverend Boykin's characters in your book. How does that inform your approach, your personal legacy?
Well, in a lot of ways, I think, well, first of all, this book is better than the one I thought I was going to write. I very much thought that I was going to write a very slick thriller. And it wasn't until I got into the writing of it that I realized that I was trying to say something bigger about the psychology of these foot soldiers during the civil rights movement and what it was like for them in the aftermath of it. It wasn't until I got to writing some later chapters that I realized I was saying something different. You could say in some ways I've been writing this book my whole life because I was trying to understand these people who raised me and what their experiences were. I was very lucky in having research at hand, being able to call my parents, call my dad in particular.
Did your dad kind of smirk at the fact that Jay Porter jumped into the water and he didn't?
No, because I think he understands why he didn't jump into the water.
Does he see any similarities between him and Jay Porter? Does he say, now, this is me right here. You know this is me right here. This is interesting.
Well, kind of. I mean, when I started doing this, I was home, and Dad and I went on a barbecue run for the family, and we were riding around, and it gave me an opportunity to say to him, look, I'm doing this thing. I'm writing this book. I'm telling you this because people are going to think that you're Jay. I know you're not Jay. You know you're not Jay, but people are going to think that you're Jay. And I'm not asking for your permission per se, but I do want to, out of respect for you, let you know what I'm doing. And he said, okay. And then for over a course of like a year or something, I would call him all the time. And I would never frame my questions. I would just be like, now, what's the name of that one organization that you formed like 6 months before Stokely Carmichael came to U of H? What was that called again? And he would answer it. And then, pretty much, because then he started getting like a little stirred up and then memories would start coming up. And so he would come, oh, well, let me tell you about this other thing. And I would say, no, actually, no, because I really don't want this to be Gene Locke's story. I want this to be Jay Porter's story. So, like I said, I think there's a part of me that's been writing this book forever because I am in some ways the child of somebody like Jay Porter.
At what point does this slick thriller become so heavy?
You know when it was for me? There's a chapter in the book. Okay, so in 81, here is Jay thinking, look, I'm going to make a lot of money, and that's going to be my new American dream. And he doesn't want to get involved in anything political anymore. He did that, and he escaped it. But he gets roped into a union fight with these longshoremen. And because he has a past relationship with the mayor of Houston, they ask him, can you approach her to give us a hand? Jay and this mayor, who is the first woman mayor of the city of Houston, have an interesting, tangled past. And I, as a writer, in order to write the scene where he goes to her in 1981 to ask for help, had to write the scene something to explain their past romantic entanglement. So I had to write it just for myself. But when I started writing it, I realized, oh, no, this is actually my book. There's something here. And to the point where I actually got scared that I was going off track. Like, why am I writing this whole chapter that takes place in 1967 about these two people falling in love? Why am I writing this? But it opened up where the book was trying to go.
We'll definitely get to that romance, a very intriguing part of the book indeed. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 on your FM dial, KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Attica Locke, author of the novel Blackwater Rising. Locke discusses and reads from that novel Blackwater Rising tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. Now, backing up a little bit to the conception of this novel, you chose to set this story in the 1980s. Why?
Well, part of it is because I think that Houston at that time was kind of emblematic of the country at large, that it most represented the blind faith in where the Reagan 80s were going. They were flush with oil in 81. The bust wasn't coming yet. It was about 18 months to 2 years away. Everybody was in a Cadillac. People were kind of living large. And there was this sense of nothing can touch us. And, this new president's in office is going to do all this great stuff, which I think, again, it's emblematic of where the whole country was. And also it was at the forefront in some ways of us trying to transition into a more progressive society. The fact that Houston had its first woman mayor, it actually did in my book and in real life, had the first woman mayor ever of the fourth largest city in the country in 1981, which when you really think about it, that's kind of late, that's when you would first be having a woman, lead a city of that size. So again, it kind of, there was something about the adolescent, you can't touch me, it's all going to be good energy that Jay is trying to catch up to, but feels like it's just out of reach, that spoke to me in some way.
So what political changes were happening in the 1980s in Houston that you felt added flavor to the story, other than the first woman mayor and the changes going on civically?
I think it's mostly that being a southern city, that it held the juxtaposition of where we were as a country, that we were both, you know, obviously moving forward. We're living in this, you know, incredible integrated society. You know, you've got, here's the fruits of the women's rights movement, that this woman's in office. But you're also in Houston, Texas in 1981. You're also seeing people, you know, you still got kind of racist cops, and you've still got that old flavor of the South in there, too. And so I think in that sense, it holds, you know, some of the contradictions about our country.
So let's talk about that legacy of racism. What do you mean in the book when you said your character knows about the long creative arm of Southern law enforcement? I thought that was a very interesting way to both make it euphemistic and put your point across at the same time. Talk about that, the long creative arm of Southern law enforcement.
Well, I mean, creative is the word. I mean, you know, the South has a history of fabricating charges against people of color and just, you know, making stuff up, frankly, whole cloth. And I think that black people and black men in particular growing up in the South have to be raised with this understanding that the truth is kind of doesn't always matter, because it's this malleable thing that you don't actually own. People in the robes, people behind the badge own the truth. They got it in their back pocket. They're going to make it look like whatever they want it to look like. And so you have to organize your life in such a way as to never get in trouble. You know, the tragedy of Jay Porter in the beginning of the book, when he does a noble thing to save this woman, but has this gut instinct that this woman is lying to me and I shouldn't be anywhere near her. I think if he were a man of a different color during a different time in our country, he would just go to the police and say, "My God, I saved this woman. I think she's involved in a crime. I don't want to have anything to do with
it." Day.
And call it a day. But he doesn't actually feel free. 20-something years after King, he doesn't actually feel free. There's a sense that for the ability to drink at a water fountain, to vote wherever, to walk wherever, there's a psychological freedom that hasn't happened yet for him.
Is Jay Porter's racial paranoia really your own?
Oh God, yes, yeah. Oh, I feel like you've known me forever, but yes, it is. And that's the other thing about the difference between me and my father, and why I never want people to think Jay Porter's racial paranoia is my own, and it is bred of being the first generation in my family to live a fully integrated existence. The supreme irony of my parents' activism is that they were fighting for a world that they actually could not prepare me for, because
right.
they'd never experienced it.
Right.
So all of this fighting to send their little girl to an integrated school, they had no way to tell a five-year-old what in the world it was going to feel like to go to an all-white school. And so,
what did it feel like?
Scary, confusing, in the sense that I was there, so there was a sense, obviously, that, you know, I belong, but then why is there only one of me in this classroom? And then also, why am I friends with somebody on Monday and then they call me a bad name on Wednesday? And those young kids were also trying to navigate what they naturally felt within their bodies, what they were hearing from their parents. It was just like, I don't know, a bunch of 5 and 6 year olds trying to navigate a new country. And I got hurt a lot. I was called names. And so some of that paranoia of who can I trust, or I think this person is my friend, but are they my friend? It very much is about my generation's paranoia. I don't know that my parents felt that way, but that's the way I felt growing up. And I think that's what Jay is going through.
Going back to the theme of activism, how did you then develop your social political IQ or repertoire, as it were, from being the first in an integrated school, but coming also from a family of activists?
Well, I mean, I actually let me start with saying I'm really kind of thankful for my experience. I think it's made me very socially nimble in life. I think I'm really good at reading a room and scanning and figuring things out. So I'm kind of very appreciative for my experience. But I've been very – if you're asking me like how I was able to, you know, write this book and put all of this history in it, you know, I did a good amount of research on everything. Some of the research was just in my bones, so to speak. I just kind of grew up hearing certain things and reading certain things. But the rest of it was just, you know, talking to my parents a lot about, you know, their experience.
And how do you draw from that experience for the book?
Well, I mean, I kind of, to hear them tell it, my mom kind of couldn't understand how I was able to capture something that I wasn't present for. She had a real emotional reaction to the book and said something so sweet. She said, "I feel seen by you. I feel like you really see me and see my life." But she couldn't understand when I wrote some of the scenes with Stokely Carmichael coming to the U of H campus that it felt like that night, and she couldn't understand it. And I don't know that I understand it either. Maybe it's that's what you call having – being a writer or having a gift. I took what information was at hand, and then I just tried to put myself there.
And going forward, you focus a lot on the different levels of access to power through activism, through political action, through economic empowerment or equality, entrepreneurship. Do you think one is better than the other?
I mean, do you think the way forward – you're asking, do I think the way forward is economic or political?
Right.
Oh, man.
Right. This is the argument coming out of the civil rights movement and one that still rages today.
I don't think you can have one without the other, and I certainly don't think you can only have the economic. I think that's a mirage. I think that's a trick.
Is this proven with Jay Porter's need to start his own business and then seeing that that's – not the means to an end that he thought it was?
I think that's part of it. I think economics is empty. I mean, I don't think that it's if the political I'm talking 2012 now. If our political system is set up in such a way to put corporations ahead of human beings or put them on par, you know, God forbid, then you can't just focus on economics. You have to have a political system that checks the economy, that checks corporate power, so that individuals don't get lost in that process. I find a kind of sadness by believing that if you have material wealth, you are free. I don't see how that's true.
Yet that seemed to be the prevailing myth or prevailing supposition in the Cosby era that Jay Porter finds himself into. Talk about a little bit about that.
I mean, I actually think that was coming from, I don't know, a place of psychological defeat, that the movement, in my opinion, kind of ground to a halt. The country shifted. The Reagan era did usher in, you know, I get this image in my mind of Nancy and Ronald and the gowns, and it just kind of ushered in this era of placing incredible emphasis on prosperity. And I think that black people felt like this other thing broke down and didn't kind of get to where we wanted it to get. Maybe money will get us there. Maybe if we have wealth and we're rich and our middle class lives mirror a white middle class life, then people will treat us fairly. But then I think that leads to people getting obsessed with, you know, material things that you fight. It's just there's a profound soullessness to it for me.
Speaking of which.
Now, wait a minute. I have to say this.
Go ahead and say it.
Let me just be real. I'm saying that, though, from my very middle class background. So you might find somebody else who is like, don't listen to her because I don't have anything. And so for me, economic prosperity is a real thing. So I have to be clear here that I'm speaking from my very middle class, three generations back background, that it has the freedom to talk about which path I think we should take. I think there are other people who are scratching and saving and struggling who might say something different.
Now, it's interesting that you bring this up and talk about how the movement ground to a sort of halt. In Jay Porter's case, the fictional character, and in your father's case, Mr. Locke, being on trial, essentially, mm-hmm. not only for their beliefs, but for their life, essentially, mm-hmm. creates that atmosphere to flip psychologically mm-hmm. and philosophically into let's just get the money.
Yeah, and that's really for the character. My dad kept going. My dad kept going. But I think for Jay Porter, there's this sense of in the book he's set up. You know, it's not like he's on trial for something he really did. He's set up. And again, he's seeing the way in which the system he could get lost here forever. He could be one of those, you know, hundreds of thousands of souls who get lost to the system. And because he gets off by a single vote, he believes, by a single juror, he feels like I've been given my life back and it's too precious for me to mess with. So I think he makes this kind of bargain with God that, okay, well, I'm just going to keep my head down now. But it's not who he really is. It's not who he really is, which is why, you know, you find him, you know, a decade later and he gets involved in this big case and the stuff that's going on in the book.
Our guest is Attic Alok, author of the novel Blackwater Rising. Alok discusses and reads from Blackwater Rising tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, more with Attic Alok. We hear about the difference between screenwriting and the novel, plus other political and philosophical issues. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Writer Attic Alok once sat in a meeting with a Hollywood executive who was reviewing a script she wrote. She was told it was too long and wordy. So it only made sense that later she became a novelist. And our guest once again for this part of the hour is Attic Alok, author of the novel Blackwater Rising. Alok discusses and reads from this novel, Blackwater Rising, tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library. Tell us about your screenwriting background. Did you choose screenwriting first, Attica?
Yes, I did. Well, you know, I went to film school. I was a fellow at the Sundance Filmmakers Lab and was for a long period of my life on a path to becoming a movie star, to becoming a director. And when I came out of the Sundance Lab, I had a movie deal. I was all set up. I think I was location scouting for the movie when they pulled the plug.
What was your movie about?
It was it took place in rural East Texas in a little truck stop town, and it was two bodies washed up in a bayou. Themes,
right?
And
reoccurring themes.
One is a local girl, a townie, and one is a black lawyer from Chicago. And the lawyer's wife ends up driving to this town, trying to figure out what in the world happened to her husband, and she gets caught into this, you know, classic kind of murder mystery.
Very sort of Heat in the Night,
very much
burning,
so. Very much
along
so.
Those types
yeah,
of lines.
Exactly. And so then, you know, I had this movie deal, and we were down in Texas scouting when they pulled the plug and said, you know, we're not making this movie.
What reason did they give?
The number one reason that I got is that, you know, in the economics of the movie business have probably shifted since then, and they're constantly shifting. But with little indie movies like that, a lot of the times they're trying to raise capital overseas in order to help finance filming it now. They want to either pre-sell or just help to raise capital from foreign markets. There is this prevailing idea in Hollywood that black material doesn't translate, which is ridiculous. My book, Blackwater Rising, has done better in London and in Paris than it has in the U.S.
Expound on that. That's an interesting supposition that is a widely prevailing myth in Hollywood, that black indie fare does not fare well overseas. Black mainstream fare does not fare well overseas. Why is that a prevailing standard?
I don't know. Other than the limitations of the people in America who've started this rumor, because I don't really see it play out. I mean, you see people in Japan who are enamored of hip hop culture. You see people in love with blues, American blues in France. I don't know what they're talking about. That a lot of the bigger parts of American culture are celebrated all over the place. But it is a rumor that is very difficult to dislodge. Some of the other challenges with making any movie in America is where we are right now with you know, at any given time, if you have a romantic comedy, there's probably three actresses that can get the movie financed. When you have a lead, a black lead, the numbers just keep they just get smaller. You know, there's maybe Halle Berry, or it just gets littler. So they're very difficult to make. What happened to me when they pulled the plug on my movie is that I was 24 years old. I had never had my heart broken professionally before. And I just was lost. I just was completely lost. And my husband was getting ready to start law school. And so I, very much like Jay Porter, was like, okay, fine. I'm going to put my head down. Nobody wants to make my movie. I'm just going to make some money. I have to help my husband go to school. I have to live. And I became this hired gun screenwriter. And I did rewrites, or I would come in and they would have an idea and then I would write it for them. And I did this for about 10 years.
So you were sort of script doctor / script surgeon / somebody who turned
other
specs and ideas into
into scripts that never got made. I was very good at writing scripts that nobody ever made into a movie.
What are the pluses of screenwriting versus long form narrative?
I can speak philosophically and I can speak technically. Technically, what I think that screenwriting offers, or what a background in screenwriting and to a certain degree playwriting as well offer, is a celebration of white space. I mean that figuratively and literally. You know, there's the white space on the page with the script, but it's also about leaving pockets and gaps where you don't literally say everything out, and you leave room for subtext. You leave room for the reader to kind of figure some things out on their own. And so I think that's a great training to have.
And of course, for the actors to interpret it later, or a director to interpret it
later. Exactly. And I think bringing a little of that into a novel, it makes it kind of dramatic and engaging. Now, I will say, part of why I decided to write a book is because I became very, very disenchanted with screenwriting. And let me put it to you this way.
So tell us about that fateful meeting where you were told your narrative flow was too long in your script.
Dare I say it out loud? I was it was actually a meeting at Jerry Bruckheimer Films, and it's literally like out of a stereotype. I mean, they were like, the guy was like playing with toys on his desk, and he just basically said there's too many words in this. And then I remember I was writing.
Was he looking down at it when he said it, he just kind of turn away like, hey, you know?
I don't even know if he read it. He just said there were too many words. But then he also told me, I remember it was a story about these three girls that got these guys off death row in Illinois. They went to, these girls were journalism students at Northwestern. And I remember when I turned in my outline, he was like, but that's what really happened. Like, that's not the – I mean, we're not making that movie. Don't give us what really happened. Give us something else. So it was kind of a strange thing. But I got – the thing about working within a studio system is that there's so much money involved that there's a way in which people feel like they can't afford to fail. And so there's a patina of fear over the whole thing. And, I mean, I one time had a meeting where people talked about what a focus group might say if we were to convene one. And we were making choices based on a focus group that hadn't even been put together yet. There's this sense of, if you're talking about millions and millions of dollars for a production, that in the creative process, you court failure and invite it into the room with you so you can figure out how to get around it. I reached a point in life and you know, in my age where that was no longer spiritually fulfilling for me, to sit with failure all the time. I one time described the difference between writing a script and a book is that to write a book is to come to the edge of a cliff and say, you know, I think I can fly. I'm going to jump. And to write a script is to come to the edge of that same cliff and pause to draw up blueprints for the contraption that will catch you when you inevitably fail. it's a different thing. And I'm at a place in my life where I want to fly and I need faith. So I like jumping off cliffs, I guess.
So speaking of that jump, when and how did you come up with the outline for Blackwater Rising? Didn't do an outline at all.
You
literally just jumped.
Had done more outlines and had more meetings about outlines than I ever wanted to have in my life. I just jumped. I wrote the way that I would approach it is I wrote that first chapter and I basically just kind of let it lead me, and I would only try and plot out maybe just the next few pages. And then I would just plot out the next few pages. And then if I hit a wall, I would circle back and start over and then write longer. But I never really came up with a comprehensive outline because I didn't want to shut off other possibilities. Sometimes you can hew too closely to your outline and miss an opportunity. where the story wants to go. Like when I stopped and wrote this whole background about Jay and Cynthia, the mayor, falling in love back in the 60s. If I had an outline, I never would have written that because I would have said that's off point.
It's interesting that you bring that up. There's a sort of a romance for activism that seeps into that romance that you touch on with Jay's college fling, who happens to be the mayor, Cynthia Maddox, later. Tell us how that comes together with Jay Porter and Cynthia Maddox, the students, and then Jay Porter and Cynthia Maddox, the criminal defense attorney slash mayor.
Right. Well, there's a theme throughout the whole book of looking where people landed after the movement. And I think of it very much as soldiers who come home from war. I'm gonna paraphrase John F. Kennedy, who one time said that we would never have true peace until the conscientious objector got a parade, just like the soldier. So I very much feel like these activists were soldiers. And, where's the fallout from that? Jay found his path where he's trying to make a scratch out of living. Cynthia found her path to establishment power as the mayor. Other people started a community center and are still wearing dashikis. Other people are in jail. Other people went crazy. So I was fascinated by that juxtaposition of Cynthia, this woman who was really involved and tried to be in SNCC, was in SDS, and somehow sloughed all that up and is now with the helmet hair Republican running a city.
Now, here's how you described her as a college student: as a white girl drawn to black radicals, as sure as if the Temptations had come to town. Now, how does she then become? How does that relationship evolve with the protagonist, Jay Porter? She's a Republican now.
Yeah.
How does that evolve?
Well, there's this question in the book about what their romance really meant. They fell in love back in the day. And it was a romance between the two of them that they kept to themselves, that it wasn't really popular to let this black man and this white woman being involved, that his friends didn't understand it. She wasn't necessarily telling her friends, but there was a way in which he could unload some things with Cynthia about his heart, his life, his mind, that he could not with his buddies. And so they became best friends and lovers. And in the end, when Jay gets set up for this crime
again,
there is a question about, did she have a hand in that? Is Cynthia not who she says she is? Is she, working undercover? And so this confusion that Jay feels about whether or not he can trust this woman and who she really is, we never really know. It never really gets answered. And I did that on purpose, that it never really gets answered who Cynthia was back in the day. But I think there's genuine affection between the two of them. And I have to say that as much as Cynthia in the story that takes place in 1981 does some things that I don't like or I don't agree with, and she's a political animal, clearly, I have tremendous compassion for her being the first woman running that city. And I think she makes some of the bad decisions that she makes from a place of, if I fail at this, they're going to say a woman can't do this. And so I think she plays dirty for some loftier goal in her head that I kind of understand. I mean, at least I have compassion.
Or because she thinks she has to. Because
she thinks she has
to.
That's
the way it's
done.
Yeah,
that's the game. That if your way of making a difference is to go the establishment route, you're going to have to make some compromises or play dirty.
Speaking of dirty mayoral politics, your father actually ran for mayor in Houston.
In 2009
and caught a little bit of flack. Yeah. Behind the book. Tell us what happened.
He did. I mean, that election was surreal for me, having written this book. Because here I had written this book about the political goings-on of a city, and then I was walking through those goings-on 30 years later. And it was all the same characters. There were the union people and the black preachers and the crack Metro reporters. And it was like walking through Blackwater Rising 30 years later. It was very, very strange. But there were some reporters who cornered my dad and took some of Jay's cynicism from the book and tried to put it on my father. That, are you cynical about the movement? You think it didn't amount to anything? And then one guy said, how can you be a law and order man, Mr. Locken? You didn't jump into this bayou to save this woman. And my dad's take on it was, God bless him.
And this is from a fiction book.
People are just looking for anything. I mean, I thought I knew how sick politics are, but I didn't really get it till I was on the ground. And it's just all theater. They're just making all this as they go along. I don't know if you got your
bleep, just making it up as they go along.
They're just making it up as they go along. Anyway, my dad was so kind. He basically told that guy, don't do that to my kid. Just you're never going to get me to say anything against my daughter and my daughter's reading of my life, her life, and don't put her in that position.
Were you interviewed about it? Were you contacted about that particular aspect of Jay Porter and the relationship to father and the backstory?
And the reporter didn't get it. He didn't understand that Jay is not, you know, a different character, but he also had no concept of the fact that my dad is in his 60s and that people, human beings change and how you can be in a place politically when you're 20 and be in a totally different place in your 60s. He didn't really understand that. And I think the media there in Houston was so invested in this idea that my dad was this former radical, and they so wanted to paint this picture on him that they couldn't really see any truth past that.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Attic Locke, author of the novel Blackwater Rising. She discusses and reads from that novel, Blackwater Rising, tonight at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library at 6:30. Now, in this novel, you focus on a lot of arch-typical institutions, unions, big oil companies, petrol, coal.
Yeah, that was the name of the fictitious company.
And all the symbols that seem to be bigger than one man. What made you take that all the way up, cover up at the top, down sort of approach?
Well, I mean, some of that is just the shape of a classic thriller. You know, a little street crime is masking some bigger conspiracy. So I definitely borrowed from, you know, that trope, so to speak. But I was, you know, the oil thing, I was actually kind of really influenced by what happened with Enron back in, what was that, 2000? In the sense that Enron was so big.
It was an institution in
Houston. It was such an institution in Houston down to, I didn't know any, you almost couldn't find anybody in the city it didn't touch, from janitors all the way to the highest levels.
To the Houston Astros.
It was all over the place. And I was really fascinated by the ripple effects of that kind of corruption. What I did with my book in terms of the oil company that's doing something shady is I made it something physical because, frankly, to this day, I don't even understand what Enron was doing. Like, I actually could never explain what they were, how they were moving the numbers around.
Turns out they couldn't explain
They couldn't explain it either. So I went with something old school and physical, where somebody's just hiding some actual oil somewhere and fudging numbers, because that's something that I could understand. So I knew that if I'm going to set corruption in Houston, there's no way that oil doesn't touch it.
You mentioned that Jay Porter's racial paranoia is a reflection of your own after having grown up in an integrated environment. Is it frustrating to look at other events such as the killing of Trayvon Martin and see this paranoia still pervasive and valid in 2012?
It's scary, and because you think you're being hyperbolic when you're writing something, like maybe you're taking something, but you're making it bigger because, you know, you're trying to make some kind of point psychologically. And then to see that what happened to that young man is exactly what Jay is afraid of. It's exactly the fear he's living in. So it's really very unnerving that we're talking 30 years later and something like that happened.
And that's what I was going to ask. In your estimation, does this event happening in 2012, what do you think it says about the country's sort of third rail topic of racial discrimination and paranoia? And how would someone like Jay Porter, or for that matter, your father, look at this murder? And how would that be framed?
Well, let me just speak for me, first of all. I think the crime on top of the crime of murder is that the system is not doing anything. That one human being overreacted, saw danger in a boy, is one human being overreacting and seeing danger in a boy. But a DA's office, but a government system then has to come in and do something about it. So that there is, to me, it is criminal that you as a system don't come in and call this what it is and put things in motion to charge this man. I'm not one to say, you know, and I'm thinking of, you know, the guy who got drugged through Texas. I grew up in Texas. You got, you know, tied to
James
the back
Byrd.
Of the thing. James Byrd. There's, you know, that's not happening every week. So there are things that happen like that. There are crimes that happen. But what's a sicker thing is that a nation and a government doesn't come up and then charge this. You have to come out in a court of law and call this what it is and call it murder and air it out, because otherwise there's no way to heal. It becomes sicker to say that this boy's life had no meaning. If one man on a street said his life had no meaning, there's that tragedy. The tragedy festers and is compounded by a government that says this boy's life had no meaning because you refused to charge this man.
Your novel, Black Water Rising, ends in a way where you get the sense that there might be a sequel. And speaking of sequels being all around about racial injustice or business corruption, subjects abound, pretty much. Is Jay Porter going to be back?
I'm about 90% positive. I think the sequel may not look like a classic sequel. I was just really moved by reading Scott Turow's latest Innocent, which was 30 years after Presumed Innocent. And he did some interesting things there with bringing in other characters, but following this man later. So I think it's coming, mainly because I think the city of Houston is something that I will always write about. It's my hometown. I'm trying to figure it out. I'm fascinated by it. So, you know, Jay Porter is a part of that fictional world that I've created. So it is coming back. And I have to say that election did it for me. I mean, it made me. I remember riding around with some jean lock buttons on and, you know, polling for my dad and all this stuff. And I looked at my sister in the car and I was like, oh, no, this is a book. This is completely a book.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm going to get to typing as soon as this is all
over. So you're going to take a little bit of that election intrigue. And
absolutely.
Put it back
in
there.
I have to because writing is my way of trying to work through stuff I don't understand. And I'm still trying to understand what happened with that election and my suspicions about how some stuff got worked out behind the scenes. I saw some ugly ways in which, you know, the media is putting on a show and there's some real stuff that's at stake for all of us. And we're getting really sidetracked by these shows that they're putting on. That's not the truth.
How are you planning to follow up on something that was so critically acclaimed? This novel got a prize from a literary institution in London, the Orange.
Yeah, it was shortlisted for the Orange Prize. That was kind of a trip to go to London and read my Texas novel there in front of all those people. But I have a new book coming out in October called The Cutting Season.
And it's set at a plantation house used as a museum and party venue. Mm-hmm. You have another real-life backstory about what makes this novel possible. Go.
Yeah, I went to a wedding in Vacherie, Louisiana in 2004, right before Katrina, and it was outside of New Orleans. And I knew the wedding was on a plantation because I'd read the invitation, but I didn't really understand what that meant. And we got bused into to the plantation, which means you have to drive through rural Louisiana poverty. And then all of a sudden, these columns come up out of nowhere. And I kind of gasped. It kind of took my breath away because you don't know what to feel. The only thing I can compare it to, because it's so beautiful, it really is I've heard Jewish people say the same thing about listening to Wagner, that there's a psychological confusion because you feel you hear the beauty, but it's twisted. It's dark because it's connected to something else.
And on top of that, you were there for
a wedding.
And your husband is white.
My husband is white. The people getting married were black and white. So we get
all types of just.
It was just really crazy. And I got off the bus, and as soon as my foot touched the ground, I burst into tears. And with my husband and I together said a prayer, because I couldn't actually walk onto the land without stopping to say a prayer. But I couldn't understand if my being there was a sign of progress, or was it a sign of sickness that we had turned this history into a party? What is this? And I was just really, really fascinated by this question. And I will say this, that plantation is still surrounded by cane farms that are still farmed. Who do you think is out in the fields now cutting the cane?
Immigrant.
It's migrants. It's
right.
Latinos. It's Mexicans. So I was kind of fascinated by this racial shell game that was being played, that the colors were being moved around on the board, but there was still a particular economic system that was still in place. And so I set a murder mystery on a plantation in 2009.
And speaking of the racial shell game, we end with a pretty big bomb, Obama.
Yeah.
You have said that you believe the election of Obama and the polarization around his presidency has interrupted the racial narrative. What did you mean by that?
I just mean that there's no way this country isn't changed. I don't know what it's changed to, but there's no way it's not changed. And I disagree both with people who say that his election means we're post-racial and people who say, well, it doesn't mean anything. You know, we still got all this, you know, problems. Maybe we do have all these problems, but there's no way to downplay. I will never downplay the fact of this man in the White House because I didn't think I would see it in my lifetime. It is deeply meaningful to me. And, you know, I know that for me personally, when I realized that he was going to be the president of the United States, I started having panic attacks. Way back in 2008, I started having these panic attacks where I was realizing that the story that I had been told about what was possible for me in this country was about to be ripped away from me. And however negative or dark that story was, it certainly was familiar. And I was going to have to understand myself, my marriage, my family, and my child in a new country. And I had to show up with some kind of courage to do that.
So what changes now as we look ahead to the reelection?
Well, my hope, my dear, dear hope, is that people are able to get in touch with where they are made uncomfortable by his presidency. Because as long as they don't do that, we're battling people's unconscious. And when you're battling their unconscious and their shadow, they end up – you have the other side taking ridiculous policies that are now spinning off into, in my opinion, a hatred of women. When you don't call out the truth and how you really feel, you start picking a fight with Obama that's illogical and nonsensical. And now you're onto another ism, which is you're beating up on women.
Our guest has been – Attica Locke, author of the novel Blackwater Rising. Locke discusses that novel tonight at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library at 6:30. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, my God. Thank you for having me.
And tune in tomorrow for Nature in the City. We'll get the latest on turkey vultures, moral mushrooms, blooming trees, and spring peppers. Our show is produced by Andreas Lindsay with help from Charlie Upchurch. Up to Date is next with a look at transparency in the Missouri and Kansas state governments. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.